Well, thank you very much for such a warm welcome, and I dearly wish that I had a really fun subject to talk about tonight. And there are such subjects, of course, but whatever they are in a fundamental way compromised by the prospect of nuclear war. Whatever your hopes and ambitions, your plans for the future, your expectations for children and grandchildren and future generations, they are all, in the most fundamental sense, in peril because of the nuclear arms race. So what I would like to do in 45 minutes to an hour is give a little perspective on how we got into this mess, what the dangers are, and what the prospects for getting out of the mess are. And then in the question period, I'd be glad to take questions not just on this topic, but on anything else that you think might be interesting. In the entire history of humans on the Earth, which is several million years old, it is only in the last few decades that we have had the capability to destroy our global civilization and possibly the human species itself. And this is, of course, mainly true because of nuclear weapons, but it's important to remember that this isn't the only area in which our technology has become so powerful that we are able to affect the planet as a whole. And any concern about nuclear weapons is a subset, although an extremely important one, of a much larger question, which is the sane and wise use of the enormous technological powers which are now at our command and will be increasingly powerful and increasingly at the command of many people on the planet. In the late 1930s, in a laboratory in Berlin, an experiment was done and published in the open scientific literature, which made it immediately clear to scientists all over the world that it might be possible to make a weapon of terrifying, unparalleled powers, a bomb the size of something between a grapefruit and an ottoman that would destroy a city. I agree. Emigre scientists fleeing Nazi-occupied Europe came to the United States, many of them of extraordinary capability, and they, for very good reasons involving their own personal experience with Hitler Germany, feared the prospect of a Nazi nuclear weapon. And some of them wrote a letter to be signed by Albert Einstein, the only scientist that the President of the United States had ever heard of, indicating the danger of this combination of the possible power of nuclear energy and the fact that the first experiments on nuclear fission in uranium had been done in Nazi Germany. And that letter, as well as a serious effort by British scientists, some of them also emigres from the mainland, led to the development of the Manhattan Project, which was intended explicitly to beat the Nazis to the atom bomb. Well, there was a Nazi atom bomb project. In fact, there were four of them, one of them sponsored by the post office. While they had excellent nuclear physicists, the main The main Nazi nuclear weapons program was led by Nobel laureate Werner Heisenberg. Nevertheless, the Nazis came nowhere near developing a nuclear weapon. And when the European war was over in May of 1945, the original reason for developing nuclear weapons had disappeared. But there was an enormous technological momentum. There was also the prospect of lots of Americans dying in the Asiatic War with Japan, and a debate ensued in the scientific community. Maybe the nuclear weapons shouldn't be developed at all any further or tested, or maybe the nuclear weapons should not be dropped on populated areas in Japan, but just a demonstration nuclear explosion. But the debate among the scientists was pointless because the political leaders made it very clear to them that this was not their concern. It's very interesting that the same scientist, Leo Szilard, who had penned the letter that Einstein had signed, who was the first person to clearly see that a self-sustaining chain reaction was possible, who had played a major role in getting the U.S. Manhattan Project going, when Germany surrendered, he was very concerned about the possible misuse of nuclear weapons and attempted once again to make contact with the President of the United States. But his letter was on President Roosevelt's desk in Warm Springs, Georgia, the week Roosevelt died, and Roosevelt's successor, Harry Truman, was not interested in talking to some scientist with an unpronounceable name, and referred him to then Secretary of State designate James F. Burns. And so Szilard and Harold Urey and one other scientist took a train to Spartanburg, South Carolina in early summer of 1945 to argue, as Szilard did very eloquently, that dropping nuclear weapons on Japanese cities would have a large number of undesirable consequences, one of which would be a nuclear arms race with the Soviet Union. Burns was appalled. He told Szilard, A, that there was no chance that the Soviet Union would develop nuclear weapons because he, Burns, had it on very good authority that there was no uranium whatever in the Soviet Union. And B, wasn't Szilard a Hungarian worried about the fact that the Soviets were taking over Hungary? Where were his, Szilard's, priorities? And Szilard, in his memoirs, says that, yes, of course he was worried about Hungary, but the disproportion of the importance of the two issues seemed to him extremely striking, that Secretary of State designate wasn't the least concerned about the possibility of a nuclear arms race, but the very short-term issues, that was all he focused on. Well, the United States went ahead. The scientists were told, many of them tried to speak out, to mind their own business, and sure as shooting, a nuclear arms race with the Soviet Union began. The general sense that when scientists provide governments with weapons, they are heroes and their advice is welcome, while when they urge cautions in the applications of these weapons, they are told to go mind their own business, is an absolutely constant and transcultural aspect of the nuclear arms race. You can see it very clearly, for example, in the history of Andrei Sakharov, who developed, more than any other person in the Soviet Union, the first Soviet thermonuclear weapon at an extremely rapid pace within the same year, essentially, as the United States did. But then, in the early 60s, when Nikita Khrushchev thought it would be a wonderful thing to explode more than a nuclear weapon a week for a year, and to explode a nuclear weapon of yield 58 megatons, by far the most powerful nuclear weapon ever exploded, Sakharov said, hey, wait a minute, this is dangerous, this is foolish, and Khrushchev. You can read in Khrushchev's memoirs what Khrushchev's response was. It was that Sakharov's a very bright fellow, doubtless, but knows nothing about politics, and please do not bring him around again. Exactly, by the way, what Harry Truman said after he first met J. Robert Oppenheimer. Said, never let me see that man again. Now, what has happened since 1945? There have been a succession of developments of nuclear weapons and of their delivery systems. In almost every case, the technological advance pioneered, if that's the word, by the United States, the Soviet Union, always, except for one or two cases, huffing and puffing to catch up, and always catching up. So that the net result is something like this. The United States is the first to develop the atomic bomb, the hydrogen bomb, the intercontinental bomber, the submarine-launched ballistic missile, multiple independently targeted reentry vehicles, anti-satellite weapons, and so on. Soviet Union is ahead in one area, ballistic, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and they test their first one about 9 months before the United States tests its. The net result is that at the present time, there are almost 60,000 nuclear weapons on the planet Earth, divided into two categories, strategic and tactical. A strategic nuclear weapon is one that is attached to a delivery system which can carry it to the potential adversary's homeland. And a tactical nuclear weapon has a more modest geographical ambition. The delivery vehicles are of enormous power, or as the president would like to say, potency. There are nuclear weapons that many of them, which can be carried in 15 or 20 minutes halfway around the world and destroy a city. In fact, destroying a city is a very interesting question. How many cities are there on the planet Earth? The answer is something like 2,300, if you define a city as having more than 100,000 people. 2,300 cities on the planet Earth. How many strategic nuclear weapons are there? The number grows every year and is by now approaching 25,000 strategic weapons. That means that if the United States and the Soviet Union made a conscientious attempt to destroy every city on the planet with their strategic nuclear weapons and to be on the safe side, devoted two strategic nuclear weapons to each city, the United States and the Soviet Union could obliterate every city on the planet Earth and have 20,000 strategic weapons left over as a an examination problem for the targeteers, which they doubtless would solve. They would find worthy additional targets, but not the 2,300 cities on the planet. In addition, there are something like 30 or 35,000 tactical nuclear weapons, many of which are much more powerful than the bombs that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 60,000 nuclear weapons. Or, to give another perspective, the United States has about 30 strategic nuclear submarines. A typical one, not the modern generation of Tridents, but the previous generation of Poseidon nuclear submarines, a single such submarine can destroy 192 Soviet cities. One submarine, commanded by one officer, usually of a rank, something like commander, and there's a few other officers that would have to agree with him if he chose to destroy 192 cities, but there's this small bunch of people. They have control over the life and death of the men, women, and children in 192 cities in the Soviet Union. There aren't many more than 192 cities in the Soviet Union. The Soviets are in some comparable position. They have a slightly different disposition of forces. The bulk of the Soviet forces are land-based. The bulk of the U.S. strategic forces are submarine-based. By the way, a fact that the President of the United States did not realize until 2.5 years into his first term of office, a somewhat sobering fact. Mr. Reagan didn't understand the first fact about the disposition of forces between the United States and the Soviet Union, and thought it was perfectly right to admit it publicly. So this is all in a parenthesis, but it's a very curious fact. No national security advisor, no secretary of defense, no presidential science advisor was able to say, excuse me, Mr. President, there's a small fact you ought to have in mind if you're considering the then Reagan idea that there would be a uniform build-down in the land-based strategic forces of the two countries, leaving the submarine forces alone. You ought to realize that that's slightly unfair from the Soviet perspective. No one ever told him that. And, of course, he didn't know it. How would he know it? And so it's not surprising that that early effort at arms control failed. End of parenthesis. I just couldn't resist. Now, this extraordinary excess of the ability to obliterate over the number of things that there is to obliterate is sometimes called overkill. There is, by the way, a general tendency in this subject to use words which distance the sayer emotionally from the horror that's being talked about. For example, I use the phrase delivery systems. It sounds like, a supermarket, right? Something to deliver the products. Delivery systems, it's the agents of worldwide death being carried halfway around the planet. We call them delivery systems. In a so-called central exchange, that's another one of those phrases, I'll give you something, you give me something, that'll be great. A so-called central exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union, how many people would be killed? Estimates vary. This is not a subject amenable to experimental verification, except more than once. From something like a few hundred million people killed outright to the estimate of the World Health Organization that 2.2 billion people would be killed outright, mainly by blast, by fires, by prompt radiation, mainly neutrons and gamma rays, and by prompt radioactive fallout, plumes of radioactivity being blown downwind of the targets. 2.2 billion people. Well, maybe it's not that bad, only a little less. Then there's the long-term effects. Long-term effects turn out to be serious. There is the persistent and long-lasting radioactivity. There is the compromise of the human immune system by sub-lethal doses of radiation. An amount of radiation that won't kill you can nevertheless significantly reduce your ability to resist disease. And imagine that happening at the same time that the doctors and the hospitals are mainly destroyed, that sanitary facilities are destroyed, that birds that are preferentially vulnerable to radiation and other environmental hazards, that are predators on insects, that carry disease microbes, are killed. Put those four together, and you can see why it is extremely likely that there will be worldwide epidemics, so-called pandemics, following a nuclear war. The compromise of the immune system is likely to be so serious that a study by physicians at Brown University have described it as a global case of AIDS, but of course not communicated by any particular activities of those who suffer from it, just activities of the leaders of the countries. They can communicate AIDS to everybody. A possibility that lends itself to metaphors that I will not indulge in. Then there is the long-term climatic effects, the fine particles of dust and soot, the latter largely from the burning of cities, raised to high altitude, blocking the sun, cooling and darkening the earth, an effect that is called nuclear winter, an estimate by a group commissioned by the International Council of Scientific Unions, about 300 scientists from 30 countries working for 3 years, concluded that the main effect of nuclear winter is likely to be massive starvation through the destruction of crops and other foodstuffs. And that study estimated that the number of people who would be killed in the long-term effects might also be several billion. Well, 2 billion plus several billion is a fair number of billions. And there only happen to be 4.8 billion people on the planet Earth. And whether we are talking about extinction or not, we are clearly talking about something extremely serious, unprecedented in human history. The stakes have never been higher. What's more, this is the year of Challenger and Chernobyl. Think of those for just a moment. High technology systems in the public view, into which enormous amounts of U.S. and Soviet national prestige have been invested. The last thing that the United States or the Soviet Union would wish to go wrong, especially with the worldwide public watching. And they were extremely confident that nothing would go wrong. An article in a Soviet English language propaganda magazine called Soviet Life, published less than a year before the Chernobyl disaster, discussed, by strange coincidence, the safety of the Chernobyl reactor. It's an interesting coincidence. And here, I've forgotten his title, some deputy minister of medium industry or some title like that, said that the mean waiting time to catastrophic failure, the average amount of years you'd have to wait before Chernobyl blew up by accident, was between 10,000 and 100,000 years. Nothing to worry about, comrades. 9 months later, boom. Likewise, NASA officials and NASA contractors made estimates of the mean waiting time to failure of a shuttle using the then prevalent shuttle launch rate and extrapolating it into the far future. And they decided that the average time you'd have to wait before shuttle blew up at launch was something like 10,000 years. Nothing to worry about, buddy. Less than a year later, boom. There is a lesson in this experience which we would be foolish to ignore. If such systems that can be repeatedly tested can sometimes fail spectacularly, how can we be sure that this vast, enormously complex arsenal of nuclear weapons will also not sometime by accident have a catastrophic failure? And people will say, oh, I'm so sorry, I must have made a mistake in the calculation. There must have been some failure mode I neglected to see. This is also the year in which Seymour Hersh's book on what actually happened in the KAL 007 shootdown is published. And what we find out from that book is that at least in the Soviet military command authority, it is possible to have enormous confusion, misunderstood orders, and a shooting down under circumstances that nobody wanted. It just happened. And I don't claim that Chernobyl and Challenger doesn't have some such sense of human error as well. There's some mix of technological and human error. And then I think it is also wise for us to remember that this is the century of Hitler and Stalin. A reminder that madmen can achieve the highest office in modern industrial states. Or, to take a more charitable view, that the leaders of modern industrial states can go mad while in office. Doesn't matter from our point of view. Put that together and tell me if you think that it is prudent to have littered the planet with 60,000 nuclear weapons, bearing in mind what those weapons can do, what a tiny fraction of those weapons can do, bearing in mind the likelihood, eventually, if you wait long enough, of technological failure, of misunderstood orders, of madness in high office, of grumpy colonel generals, of presidents who have just had a fight with their wives. Just think of the number of concatenations of individually unlikely circumstances that sooner or later will happen. Is it wise, no matter what the reasons are, to have such vast arsenals, considering what the consequences of a failure might be? That's a rhetorical question. Now, what solution can we imagine to this trap that the United States and the Soviet Union have set, not only for their own people, but essentially for everybody on the planet Earth? By the way, they, of course, didn't mean to set a trap. They were doing this only from the highest motives on both sides. They were patriots. They did it to protect what they hold dear, both the Americans and the Soviets. Each side has a list as long as my arm of abuses committed by the other. And only about 50% of those abuses are imaginary. The other 50% are absolutely true. And so each side always has an abuse on the other side that it can point to justify its own abuse. And everyone being swept up in patriotic fervor, in the conviction that their own nation is, of course, right, only has to look one step back to justify the next ratchet up the arms race. And so it simply continues without limit. What are the solutions? It seems to me there are only two categories of solutions. One is that you protect yourself against those 60,000 nuclear weapons, or the ones that you figure you are not yourself already in control of, and the other is that you get rid of them. It's hard to think of another alternative. If the only point of nuclear weapons is to make sure that the other side doesn't use their nuclear weapons, an extremely small number of nuclear weapons would suffice for that purpose. As my example of the 2,300 cities or the 192 strategic warheads on a Poseidon submarine indicates. Well, this first alternative to protect yourself is called Star Wars, or the Strategic Defense Initiative. It has lately been in the news, and let me try to say something about it. When I was growing up, I used to read science fiction, and there was a wonderful thing in science fiction called a force field. And it worked like this. There was a city, let's imagine the city's right here, and then over it, there was a, well, force field. Don't ask how they did it. And this force field, this force field permitted air molecules to get through it, which obviously you needed to breathe. It permitted sunlight to get through, which obviously you needed. It let friendly airplanes get through. But it didn't let bombs get through. The bombs would drop on it and go boing and slither off. Now, suppose we had force fields today. And imagine one was put over the United States and another was put over the Soviet Union. What would be wrong with that? So let's imagine. Soviets decide for some reason, some unimaginable reason, to make a devastating strategic attack on the United States and launch 10,000 warheads. Takes maybe 15, 20 minutes. Come to the United States, strike our force field, go boing, and slither off into the Gulf of Mexico. Great. Everybody's fine. Or suppose the United States, for some unimaginable reason, decided to fire its 10,000 strategic warheads at the Soviet Union. They take 15 or 20 minutes to get to the Soviet Union. They hit the Soviet force field. They go boing, and they slither off into the Sea of Okhotsk. What's wrong with that? My answer is absolutely nothing is wrong with that, provided the shields are impenetrable and the force fields are erected simultaneously. There is nothing wrong with that. Both sides are protected from intimidation by the other. Of course, the rest of the world that doesn't have force fields, they got a lot to worry about. But they got a lot to worry about anyway. But I maintain that the moment these shields are not impermeable, or the moment that these shields are not erected simultaneously, then the entire story changes, and these shields are extremely dangerous. The world is much more at risk with an imperfect shield in place than with no shield at all. And let me now try to explain why that seems to be the case. The president's vision, that's his word, vision, is to make a shield which will render Soviet nuclear weapons, quote, impotent and obsolete, close quote. That means a shield that will protect the civilian population of the United States against a massive Soviet strategic attack. By the way, this word impotent has a meaning. There are many possible words that the president could have reached for. The fact that he reached for that one says something. And it says, I think, it's just another piece of evidence, that there is an important and hidden psychosexual aspect of the nuclear arms race, which you can see in many other places. I will in a moment talk about penetration aids. There are also missile erectors. The language of the nuclear arms race is full of such imagery, and all you have to do is look at a strategic missile and you can understand what pops into the minds of these guys. And this is again a parenthesis. A few years ago, one of the aerospace companies was delivering missile sets to wavering members of Congress. And it went something like this. You can, of course, make a model of a missile any size you wish. What they did is to show the U.S. strategic arsenal, a bunch of missiles, all but that size. And over here they had the Soviet strategic arsenal, and they're all about that size. And what they asked the members of Congress is, which set would they prefer to have? And somehow, those were the ones that everybody liked. End of parenthesis. I mean, I think it is very striking how few women there are who are vigorous proponents of the nuclear arms race, how few women there are who are in positions of authority on either side about nuclear arms. It's only something that interests the men. End of parenthesis. (Clears throat) Make Soviet warheads impotent and obsolete. Now, does anybody besides the President and the Secretary of Defense believe that it is possible to build a shield that can make nuclear weapons impotent and obsolete? The answer is, to first order, no. Nobody believes it, including all of the top officials of the President's own Strategic Defense Initiative Organization, including Lieutenant General James A. Abramson, who I had the opportunity to debate at the Department of State this summer. None of them believe it's possible. In fact, what they talk about is enhancing deterrence, which means protecting missiles, making it tougher to destroy, for the Soviets to destroy American missiles, not to protect the cities. It can't be done. And that is why Senator Albert Gore of Tennessee has described what has been happening as bait and switch. And since you're all law students, you know just what that's about. For those who aren't law students, it's like this. It's a television ad which says, come to Honest John's used cars. And there you can buy a 1984 Mercedes convertible for $2,300. Sounds pretty great. So we go over there, and it turns out that the Mercedes convertible is not available. But wouldn't you like a Camaro for $6,400? It's only 10 years old. That's called bait and switch. To protect the civilian population in the United States sounds pretty great. Remove us from the specter of knowing that guys halfway across the world can make a decision which will result in the deaths of us and everybody we know in 20 minutes from now. Be nice not to be in that position. And the idea of a Star Wars that will protect all of us from that is, of course, attractive and politically effective. But it turns out that nobody believes that it can be done. If you push the technically competent people in the Department of Defense who are advocates of Star Wars, you find that they will allow that after the expenditures of enormous amounts of national treasure, in one or two or three decades, it might be possible to develop a system which would shoot down 70 or 80 or maybe even 90% of the incoming Soviet warheads. Well, we can do a little arithmetic. If the Soviets maintain their present strategic arsenals and don't increase it, then they shoot 10,000 warheads at us, we shoot down 90% of those warheads, that means 10% gets through. 10% of 10,000 is 1,000. 1,000 nuclear weapons exploding on American soil destroy the United States. United States obliterated, removed from the earth as a functioning political entity. If Star Wars works. But of course, the Soviets are not likely to sit on their hands for 10 or 20 or 30 years while the United States develops Star Wars. And they have many options open to them. For example, they can overwhelm. They can increase the number of strategic warheads. So, to take an arithmetically simple example, suppose they believe that the United States might be able to make a system that's 50% effective, shoot down 50% of the Soviet warheads. All they have to do is double the number of strategic warheads. And then they can inflict exactly the same amount of damage on the United States. Except that the United States will have spent an enormous amount of money in developing these new and, many people think, pie-in-the-sky technologies. And all the Soviets have to do is use existing technologies or slight modifications of existing technologies. In fact, their big strategic boosters are incompletely MIRVed. That is, on their existing strategic rockets, many of them, they can put many more warheads. They don't have to build new missiles. That's a race that the United States will clearly lose. So they can overwhelm us. They can also underfly us. SDI is for strategic missiles, missiles on those long arcing trajectories going well out of the atmosphere from the Soviet Union to the United States or vice versa. That is not the full range of strategic delivery systems available. Star Wars would, for example, do nothing about cruise missiles, which follow the contours of the land at very low altitude, would do nothing about ballistic missiles on depressed trajectories from submarines, let's say, would do nothing about light aircraft or low-altitude aircraft. I remind you that the United States leaks like a sieve to light aircraft, that every day small airplanes filled with cargo, which have just about the same volume as a nuclear weapon, although the specific density is much less, penetrate our borders. SDI does nothing about motorboats entering our harbors. SDI does nothing about nuclear weapons mailed in diplomatic pouches. Diplomatic pouch can be the size of a truck. It sounds like something you wear in your belt. Diplomatic pouch, huge things come in diplomatic pouches. Nobody's supposed to look what's in there. So for all we know, there are Soviet nuclear weapons already in some bus locker in downtown Boston. And the more emphasis put on Star Wars, obviously, is the greater is the incentive to the Soviet Union and anybody else who wants to do the United States harm to go to these other delivery systems, many of which, by the way, are technologically much simpler than ballistic missiles. So you figure out if that's the direction we wish to go in. Then the Soviets have the option of outfoxing. So instead of imagining 10,000 warheads coming at us, let's imagine 10,000 warheads surrounded in a so-called threat cloud of hundreds of thousands of decoys and, here we go, penetration aids. That is, warheads that are made to look like decoys, decoys that are made to look like warheads. You can recognize that that will significantly increase the uncertainty of the defenders. And this then brings us to the issue of how are you going to manage that? 10,000 warheads, hundreds of thousands of decoys and penetration aids. You have, should you choose to accept this assignment, you have 20 minutes, and you must shoot down all 10,000 of those warheads. Or you could shoot down all the decoys also if you have enough wherewithal. Now, to do that, you need a very interesting computer program. It is so interesting that it cannot be written by any human beings. It can only be written by another computer. It is so complex that it cannot be debugged by human beings. It can only be debugged by another computer. And, for the most fundamental reasons imaginable, it cannot be tested in a full-up way, short of having a nuclear war to test it out, and even the most fervent advocates of Star Wars do not propose that. Remember, Chernobyl and Challenger were tested at a level far exceeding the level at which the so-called battle management computer program can be tested. They were tested operationally for years. Star Wars cannot be tested operationally, except by having a nuclear war. So we simply hand over the defense of the United States and, in a fundamental way, the safety of the human population of the planet Earth to a fundamentally untestable computer. I maintain that that alone is Looney Tunes. It's madness. Then there's the issue of cost. How much would such a system, many tiers of defenses, a variety of lasers and kinetic energy kill vehicles and particle beam weapons and all the rest of it, what does it cost? Present estimates, and
and there is a fairly good level of agreement on this, are that it would cost between $1 and $2 trillion. $1 trillion is $1 million million dollars. How much is $1 trillion? $1 trillion is twice the total indebtedness of all third world countries to all Western banks. $2 trillion is the national debt. The national debt. The one that the president complains about. This president, by the way, has added to the national debt not only more dollars than any previous president has, he has added more dollars to the national debt than the sum of all previous presidents going back to George Washington. But he pleads he preaches fiscal responsibility, so we know his intentions are honorable, and it is unseemly for us to examine too closely the cost of Star Wars. His heart is pure. $2 trillion. You know, it's an interesting question. How much money has been spent on the Cold War since the Cold War was enunciated in the late 40s? I happen to have this number in constant 1977 dollars. Don't ask me why. Obviously, it could be converted into any other kind of dollar you want. But in constant 1977 dollars, the total amount of money that the United States has spent on the Cold War since the late 40s will be, by the end of the Reagan administration, $3.7 trillion, Star Wars apart. How much is $3.7 trillion? $3.7 trillion is enough to buy everything in the United States except the land. Every house, every industry, every ship, every airplane, every baby's diaper, all the buildings in Harvard Yard, everything in the United States except the land. Is this the best use of our money? Another rhetorical question. $1 to $2 trillion. There are a lot of other problems with Star Wars, including it representing a flagrant, not peripheral, but flagrant violation of something like 4 or 5 of the central strategic treaties that the United States has signed. But in the interest of time, I won't go into that. It also involves a redirection of the most fundamental sort of American science and technology in a particular direction, which is guaranteed to increase the economic disadvantage that the United States now has in the worldwide economic competition with other nations. We have gone in this administration from being the world's premier technological exporter to becoming the world's premier technological importer. Dramatic change. But I won't talk about that. What I will like to talk about, one last problem with it, is what is the Soviet perception of Star Wars? What makes them so nervous? If it won't work, why should it bother them? So, this being an interesting question, I've put it to various Soviet colleagues and Soviet political leaders, and I get two kinds of answers. And I want to stress that it doesn't matter whether the answers are right. What matters is whether they believe it. The first answer is that this is simply economic warfare, that it is an attempt by the United States to reach for any new technology. They point to the entire history of the nuclear arms race going back to 1945, which will require an expensive Soviet response. The net result is to keep Soviet wealth out of the domestic civilian sector, and therefore, in the view of the Soviets, what the American objective is to increase dissent and unrest in the Soviet Union because of the unavailability of consumer products. The second reason, which I consider much more worrisome, goes like this. We understand, the Soviets tell us that Star Wars can't protect the civilian population of the United States. We know that just as well as you. So what's it really good for? It is really good for one thing, they say. Suppose the United States wished to have a devastating first strike on the Soviet Union, which knocked out the vast majority of the Soviet of retaliatory strategic forces. Of course, you can't knock them all out. There will be airplanes in the air. There will be submarines out at sea. There will be mobile missiles that the United States won't find. And those residual retaliatory forces will, of course, fire at the United States. But they will be a sufficiently small fraction of the Soviet strategic forces that Star Wars can shoot them down, even if it can't shoot down the bulk of the Soviet forces. Therefore, the Soviets say, what Star Wars is really about in 10 or 20 or 30 years is an indication that the United States wishes to make a devastating first strike on the Soviet Union. Now, if the Soviets believe that, and it's no good saying the United States has never done a sneak attack. I mean, those guys are, you know, we could look at Grenada, and there are a few things that we could point to. But never mind that. Suppose the United States never has. These guys would have to be asked to bet their national security on the idea that the United States, with the tools to make a devastating first attack with little consequence, would not do so. That's asking too much. If the Soviets believe that that's what we're about, then the Soviets have a very important incentive to strike first before Star Wars is too far along. Now, of course, we know that. So that gives us an important incentive to strike them before they strike us, before we strike them. And then you can see this mad Alice in Wonderland logic propagating from two or three decades in the future back through time to the present. So to summarize, Star Wars cannot protect the civilian population of the United States, can be overwhelmed, underflown, outfoxed, is ruinously expensive, and is likely to increase, not decrease, the chances of nuclear war. Except for that, it's a terrific idea. Now, what's the alternative? The alternative, which, if we can believe some members of the American administration, but not other members of the American administration, was almost achieved at Reykjavik a couple of weeks ago. Namely, a massive reduction in the strategic arsenals, which in my mind is the only solution which does not depend on fundamentally untrustworthy assumptions about the safety of machines and humans. How do you do it? Do you have to trust the Russians? No, you don't have to trust the Russians. There are excellent ways to do it. For example, let me give you a scheme proposed by Admiral Noel Geiler. I'll give you his credentials so you don't think he's just some liberal Harvard professor, if there are any left. Admiral Geiler, now retired, was commander-in-chief of all U.S. forces in the Pacific, was deputy chief of naval operations, was deputy director of the Joint Strategic Target Planning Staff, the guys who decide which places in the Soviet Union are most worthy of receiving American nuclear weapons, and former director of the National Security Agency. Admiral Geiler's idea goes like this. There is a bilateral facility manned and womaned by American and Soviet technicians and scientists to which are brought not the thermonuclear weapons themselves, but the fission triggers of the thermonuclear weapons, the A-bombs inside the H-bombs, the match that lights the thermonuclear weapon. So imagine It's day one after the signing of the Treaty of Hiroshima. And on this side comes in a white-coated technician with stars on and stripes on her shoulder. And she is wheeling something the size of an ottoman, and it has stars and stripes on it. And over on this side, there is a another white-coated technician, and she has stars and stripes on her coat, and she has an ottoman which has stars. I said stars and stripes. Sorry, it's hard to keep them straight. Hammer and sickle on her shoulder, and a hammer and sickle on the thing the size of the ottoman, and they both wheel them in. And over here at the center of the room, there are technicians with the equivalent of Geiger counters. And they determine that indeed there is weapons-grade plutonium or uranium here, and they keep accumulating them at a very large rate. You might worry that the other side will build nuclear weapons to compensate for the ones that are being handed in, but to do that in a significant way is very tough if you have the present capability of overhead photographic reconnaissance satellites. And if this is something that really worries you, then you insist upon intrusive in situ inspection, which the Soviets have already agreed to on a number of other issues, including nuclear testing. In fact, implemented in that case. What do you do with these warheads, with these fission triggers? Geiler says that you build safe nuclear power plants, not impossible, just have to be careful and not give it to people whose main motive is greed, and you then convert the fissionable material into electricity, the ultimate in beating swords into plowshares. That's one scheme, and I mention it only to give some sense of reality to the idea. Do you have to trust the other side? How could you possibly imagine going from the present situation to the one I've just described? Well, Reykjavik suggests that it's not nearly as hard as we might have imagined, but of course Reykjavik, the possibilities of Reykjavik, extraordinarily hopeful, historic reversal of the nuclear arms race, was thrown away by the President of the United States because it would restrict, not eliminate, but restrict research on Star Wars to the laboratory. An enormous tragedy. But then there is some question about whether the president understood what he was saying, because the present confusion about whether he was talking about all strategic weapons or just ballistic missiles seems to me consistent with the story I told you before about the president not understanding what the disposition of forces between the United States and the Soviet Union's strategic forces were 2.5 years into his presidency. The United States and the Soviet Union remind me of an old married couple who can't stand each other very much, but for some reason, religious scruples, the avoidance of gossip, benefit of the children, some reason, can't get a divorce. And so they have to live with each other, much as they hate it. Now, each side has an exquisite knowledge of all of the faults of the other. And there's plenty of faults to pass around on both sides. But the thing is that neither nation recognizes its own faults. It only sees the faults of the other. Now, you know that real married couples like this, and there are many of them around, have no hope of reconciling their problems until they are willing to realize their own contribution to the problem. That's the first task of a marriage counselor, if they go to one. But they're not likely to go to a marriage counselor because doing so is already a token of admission that each of them has some responsibility for the problem. So each blusters, each is full of of self-righteous indignation. Each can point to, as I said before, abuses on the other side. And you look into those abuses, sure enough, they did those abuses. And there is no one on the planet who is a suitable marriage broker. Who would be a marriage broker to the superpowers? There is only one category of marriage broker, and that is the people. It seems to me it is the only possibility. Now, the United States and the Soviet Union have oscillated in their relations. Sometimes, when I was in college, it seemed to me that it was this way. The United States was quite reasonable, the Soviet Union intransigent and obdurate. Other times, it's the other way around. This time is one of those other ways around. This moment is when the Soviets have stopped nuclear testing for the last 14 months. Not a single Soviet nuclear weapon has been exploded. The Soviets invited the United States to join this moratorium. The American response has been contemptuous. 22 American nuclear weapons exploded. That's our answer to the Soviets. Why are we blowing up these weapons? Well, first thing we said was because the Soviets had just completed a flurry, that was the word, flurry, of their own tests. And now that they are ahead, 60,000 nuclear weapons, what does ahead mean? Now that they're ahead, they want us to stop. We will not be snookered by those Soviets. Well, take a look. The Soviets stopped on August 6, 1985, the 40th anniversary of Hiroshima. How many nuclear weapons did they explode from January to August of that year? The answer is 9. 9 is below the average of the United States and the Soviet Union for that 7-month period. There is no flurry. So, this is pointed out to the administration. They say, oh, did we say flurry? Sorry, it's not a problem of flurry. The problem is verifiability. The Soviets will not permit in situ verification, and without that, we can't trust them not to test. So, an American environmental organization called the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington negotiated an agreement with the Soviet Union for an American seismic network manned by American scientists and technicians to be emplaced at the Soviet nuclear test site near Semipalatinsk in Kazakhstan. There is such an agreement. There is such a network. It's in existence at the present time. There are Americans there listening for nuclear explosions. Of course, they hear none from the Soviet Union. There are quite a number from the United States. So, administration officials tapped on the shoulder. Did you say verification was the problem? Look, there's an in-situ network. Oh, did we say verification was the problem? Well, it's not exactly that kind of verification. See, it goes like this. The Soviets have a number of options open to them. And now I know this will sound as if I'm making it up, but I'm not. Here are the three ways, according to this administration, that the Soviets will cheat. First, they will wait for a natural earthquake in Kazakhstan and then explode their nuclear weapon. It's going to be sluggish testing. In addition to which, new seismic evidence suggests very strongly that there is a different seismic signature to a natural earthquake than to a nuclear explosion. Okay, well, you don't buy that. Then there's the second way the Soviets are going to cheat. The Soviets are going to decouple. They're going to build a huge cavern in the earth, suspend a nuclear weapon from the center of the cavern, blow it up, and then the walls will wiggle less than if it were the nuclear weapon were exploded in contact with the solid soil. That's true. You can decouple. It's not nearly as effective as the administration believes, but it can be done. But not for high-yield nuclear weapons. Only for the very lowest-yield ones, which aren't the ones that worry us. And then, you don't like that, finally, there is the third method in which the Soviets will cheat. And I'm sorry to say that this was even proposed to the Congress by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff as why we cannot stop testing. It's because the Soviets will test their nuclear weapons on the far side of the sun. You got that? In the Earth's orbit, but around there, on the other side of the sun. Now, I maintain that the existence of such arguments is a confession of intellectual and moral bankruptcy. So what I say is it's time to stop testing. It's time to stop Star Wars except for a minimum prudent level of research. It's time to make major divestments bilaterally and verifiably of nuclear weapons, especially the most destabilizing sort first. And if we have $1 or 2 trillion to throw around, I can think of a great many crying needs involving, for example, the fact that the United States is now 19th in the world in infant mortality, the fact that 40% of the children in New York City are living below the poverty line. I can see a use for that $1 or 2 trillion in increasing American competitiveness, in increasing education, in wiping out diseases worldwide. There are things we can do that don't involve weapons that can increase the national security of the United States far more than continuing to pump up the nuclear arms race. And I hope that an unaccustomed wave of reason will overcome this administration, that it will come to its senses, and that we will make it into a future where we can be proud that we have done something to make the world safer and not more dangerous. Thank you very much.